more on this, we bring in our own Mark Feinsand. Mark, we've all been waiting for this deal to finally break. What do you know?
So, you know, the Mets have been talking to Alonso for a while. Ultimately, there were two offers on the table, as John mentioned, 3 years and $71 million, 2 years and $54 million. He opted for the shorter-term deal. They both had opt-outs, but this had more money in the first year. So he's going to earn $30 million this year. There's a $10 million signing bonus, a $20 million salary. And, you know, the idea for Alonso is he's going to go out, have a good year, and go do this again next year, much like other fellow Scott Boras clients, Blake Snell, Matt Chapman, Carlos Correa. They all had that opt-out situation. Chapman obviously signed his big extension before actually becoming a free agent, but Snell became a free agent and cashed in this winter. Correa opted out. He got his big deal. And I think Alonso, for him, the hope is that this is that sort of one-year bridge deal and that he can go out on the market next year and land that long-term. Remember, he turned down a seven-year, $158 million extension less than 2 years ago. So for him, this is now, you know, he's going to wait till next winter to see if he can finally call that a good decision or not.
Yeah, short-term, this seems to work out really well. I also was reading about a $10 million signing bonus, so not too bad as you're heading down to spring training. Mark, you work in the New York area. Can you just give those around the country a better sense of the timeline of these negotiations going all the way back, really, to the regular season?
Yeah, you know, like I said, they've been the Mets tried to extend Alonso 2 seasons ago, summer 23. He turned it down. He switched agents. He went to Scott Boras, theoretically, with the idea that he was going to be able to land himself a huge deal as a free agent this offseason. The Mets obviously spent a lot of money on Juan Soto, $765 million. They were interested in bringing Alonso back the whole time, but not on a long-term deal that he had been looking for. So, you know, Alonso had talked to other people, other teams. Toronto was a team that kept coming up as a potential suitor for him. Ultimately, you know, he decided he wanted to go back to the Mets. I don't know what the exact offer, if there was any, from Toronto was. But with Soto now in the lineup, in addition to Alonso returning, you know, the Mets certainly have added some firepower to their lineup this winter. This keeps Mark Vientos at third, which takes them out of the Alex Bregman sweepstakes. So now Scott Boras' next goal is to get Alex Bregman signed somewhere.
So how do you put in perspective the excitement of this offseason, the roller coaster of this offseason, and ultimately what David Stearns and Steve Cohen have done for this franchise in this offseason?
Well, I wouldn't call it a roller coaster at all. The Mets won the offseason once they signed Juan Soto. I mean, that was the greatest, most important, most impactful acquisition in the history of the New York Mets. Then they went out and they re-signed Sean Manaea, and they brought in Clay Holmes and Frankie Montas and A.J. Minter, and Jesse Winker came back, and now the icing on the cake is getting Pete Alonso. The Mets have improved their position vis-a-vis the Phillies and the Braves in the National League East. I think even without Alonso, they would have gone in as the favorites. Now I think they're absolutely the favorites in the National League East. And the Mets won the offseason, and they would have had a successful offseason even if Pete had left. But as I said before, I never expected there to be a rift in the continuation of Pete Alonso as an all-time Met. And hopefully he stays for years to come, but at least we know he'll be wearing number 20 for the Mets in 2025.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Thursday, February the 6th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And don't forget the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to a midweek emergency podcast edition of the Talking Mets Podcast, one that I'll gladly love to put out there. Usually when you do these midweek things, especially early in the Steve Cohen tenure, there was some kind of scandal or crisis or, you know, something that was obviously not a positive development. But now in the wee hours, well, late Wednesday night into the early morning hours Thursday, the news came down. Like I said on Sunday, our long nightmare is over. Our long Mets nightmare is over. Pete Alonso returning to the Mets on a two-year deal with an opt-out. He becomes the highest average annual value paid first baseman in the history of baseball. That will be broken by Vlad Guerrero, undoubtedly. And, you know, really, like I had said on Sunday, the Super Bowl is that point where you say, all right, enough. Like, the winter's over. Yeah, I get Punxsutawney Phil says there's 6 more weeks of winter, but those 6 weeks will be spent with baseball fans like us watching spring training and dreaming of warm summer days while the Mets are down working out in Port St. Lucie. But really, the Pete Alonso situation, and it's funny, earlier in the evening, Andy Martino was on Baseball Night New York on SNY, and it was really... And it was, I don't know if it was a message that he was sending, if he knew something, or it was just fortuitous, but he had said something like, hey, spring training's starting. Both sides need to find a resolution. It was almost a message. And then there were the jokes all across social media. It's Pete Alonso, the witness protection program. And personally, and I said this on Sunday when we talked not just about Pete Alonso, but you know, but the team in general. Once that Blue Jays information came out, once Amazing Day happened and Cohen made his comments, and nothing transpired with Alonso signing somewhere else, I always felt like, and there was enough rumors, there was enough smoke, there was enough clues by the insiders that really are tied into Boris, that you know, they were going to work something out. There was the mechanics of the contract, the years, the money. And that's probably what they've been talking about for the better part of a week. And it turns out, and the name of this show, the theme of this show is A Convenient Marriage. Because I don't know if it'll be a convenient marriage after 2025. And I know what I had talked about on Sunday. We went into the thinking of an analytics front office where if you bring Pete Alonso back and you have the same Pete Alonso season with this group and using some of the projections, the publicly available projections, who knows if they're aligned with what Stearns and his group have, Alonso's worth like a tenth of a run. If you take Alonso in the best season of his career in 2019, he's worth 3/10 of a run. Look, that's analytics semantics. And Joel Sherman is right. There is a certain energy level, and you heard some of the clips coming in, confidence level, the non-measurable by analytics kind of things that create a persona or an energy or belief about a team. And Pete Alonso coming back, adding that power to the middle of the lineup. And quite honestly, giving Alonso a chance to, I don't want to say revive his career, but put himself in a position where he gets paid. If he has a big year, he gets paid. He's teamed up with Soto. I know he's not Aaron Judge. I'd be very curious how they're going to work the batting order. Will Pete be protecting Soto? Will Soto be more of a protection for Alonso? You know, it'll be interesting how Vientos plays into the lineup dynamic and the components. That's another conversation for another day. We'll kind of look into that, I'm sure, over the next few days and what have you. But the Mets really did need another bat. I understand that Jared Young maybe could be the Mets' Max Muncy, and Brett Beatty still is a top prospect that has... components of an offensive game that can make up for some of what Alonso provided. But from the Mets' perspective, it puts that power bat in the middle. Guys that have the power that Pete has do not grow on trees. It adds an added bonus from a marketing standpoint, from a fan component standpoint. Remember, this is an entertainment sport. If it's just Strat-O-Matic baseball and it's just numbers, does it matter who's on the cards? It doesn't matter. If the stats match, you build a derivative offense. That's not a marketing way to build a real team. And then having the fans follow Pete's home run chase to pass right and Strawberry and all that stuff, you know, that's going to be fun. I mean, that's not why you overpay, but that's going to be fun. So there was a need for Pete Alonso in the Mets lineup. It wouldn't have been the end of the world. I think it would have been interesting. It would have put a tremendous amount of pressure on Stearns. If any kind of derivative of what they tried to replace Pete Alonso with got off to a bad start in April, and God forbid Soto struggles the first month of the year, it would add a real negative pall around the team in a big media market. We saw how that could have an impact. It would just make things harder for this group that's coming off a really solid, really fun, transformative for the organization, for the franchise year in 2024. And let's face it, everybody talks about the Dodgers. The NL East is still pretty tough. The Braves are getting some of their big guys back. They had a ton of injuries last year. Anybody who says that did impact them is fooling themselves. Maybe they weren't playing as well as everybody thought before the injuries, but they're still a bet to be right up there and potentially be a mid-90s team, really good pitching. The Phillies, maybe they're not as good as advertised, but they still have those core offensive players. They have tremendous starting pitching. Anytime you have pitching that the Phillies have, players that could, high level, top five, top 10 pitchers that, could go deep into the games, mitigate the variability of the bullpen, that's a dangerous team. So the Mets are in the mix. Do I think the Mets are the best team in the NL East? I don't know. As you know, what we always talk about here at the podcast is the getting to know you phase. And we're not even there yet. We're just kind of like, all right, what do the pieces look like in spring training? We're starting to look at this and start to build questions that will be answered over the first 60 to 90 days of the season. So it was absolutely necessary for the Mets to get Pete Alonso. Now, on the Pete side, it sounds like he may have taken more money in the first year that the Blue Jays did not have in their offer. I'm sure the Canadian tax component played into that. The Blue Jays apparently had a bigger offer of 3 years on the table. Again, Toronto always seems to be the bridesmaid in these free agent conquests. It's interesting, and they might be getting a complex here. And he wanted to get, and I said this a couple of years ago, and I don't want to be the I told you so, but I'm going to be the I told you so this morning. I said after Pete's big 2022 season, when Judge got the contract and he had that big derby where it was Judge deciding between San Diego and San Francisco, and then the Yankees stepped up, that Pete was going to want a $30 million AAV. Now, the other part of that, which we could not have predicted as things change economically in some cases in the game, and Pete's game evolved or morphed into this corner infielder that, in a lot of ways, the analytics crew sees to be fungible. He wasn't going to get the 10-year deal. He wasn't going to get the $300 million or the 7-year deal, $280. Now, in the end, he gets $30 million. He opts out. Let's say he has a big year. Maybe he goes out and gets another $150 million or so, 5 or 6 year deal. Boris turns around, who right now, Boris, and I'll get to him in a minute because he's playing Iglesias into not having a job at all. He winds up surpassing what he turned down in May of 2023, if it is indeed the rumors that were out there are true, 7 years, $158 million. So if I'm Pete, I do that. Does he fire Boris after this season? Does he? I don't know. That'll be an interesting question. I think Boris is a great agent. I don't know if Boris is good for every player. The reports that came out about Iglesias, we'll get to that in a minute. That's maybe he's not the kind of player that a Boris wants to that wants Boris representing him, the hard line, especially in an environment where there's uncertainty economically. There are owners looking to go out there and basically shut the sport down in a couple of years who are not spending. And there's only so many seats at the table with teams that need a certain position. Boris may not be that guy for everybody. And personally, if I'm Alonso, and I'm not going to get deep into that today, make some money in the next 2 years, this year and next year, because if there is a lockout, if there is a strike, the players are going to lose money. That's what happens. The players will lose money at some point in some way, shape, or form. And I don't think the sport's going to lose a season. I hope not. I don't think they could afford that, but I think we're headed for something pretty ugly in a couple of years. So if I were a player, buckle up, make sure that you, get your payments now, get paid now, because you don't know what the future brings at that point. So it was a convenient marriage for both sides. The Mets really needed that bat. They needed it maybe more from a marketing standpoint, but I'm not yet, as much as far as I've come analytically, where you could reframe and look at things in, from a different lens. Every day when I go back and look at old Mets teams from the 80s, the 90s, even the turn of the century, and I think back to what I thought about certain players and how indispensable they were or how good they were, and then I start to dive into the numbers and really compare what the eyes said to the numbers, you start to have a lot of narratives dispelled. You start to understand moves maybe a little bit better. But some combination of Jared Young and Beatty and Vientos at first, and you know maybe they were going to go out and get a third baseman at some point. And certainly I understand you could probably get some kind of right-hitting, power-hitting bat that could play a corner, even if it's a platoon situation. And you could find that without breaking the bank mid-season. But why do that? So now that this marriage of convenience is together, I'm also going to put another thing out there. I saw some stuff. I didn't play the clip. These content creators that don't handle their own emotions, talking about Pete being angry, Pete coming in here not being happy. If that, first of all, was the case, he wouldn't be here. He would have signed with Toronto a week ago. And business is business, and the players, just like the teams can't have it both ways, the players can't have it both ways. The players can't say, hey, listen, I love playing for the Mets, or I love playing for Team X, and you know, I love the fans, I want to be here for life, but by the way, it's all business when it gets to free agency. Once you enter the free agency, and you're talking dollars and cents and long-term contracts and all the other stuff that comes with it, you can't worry about your feelings being hurt. Nobody likes arbitration. Arbitration is a little different because you're under control of the player and you have to actively bash the player in a hearing. Nobody wants to hear that. It's almost like, you know, being, you know, someone listening to you bitch about your spouse. I mean, nobody wants that. But that's the part of the arbitration process. That's a little bit different, but that's business too. I mean, it doesn't mean you don't like the player, but any player, you know, Edwin Diaz, big time players, Nimmo, even Lindor, you could make arguments as to, okay, these are concerns I have. You know, Soto, these are concerns I have. They don't sound good when you hear them, and they make you think that, oh, well, you don't like me as much as you say you do. No, it's not that I don't like you. There are things that always go into the evaluation process. So I don't want to hear junior psychologists, people who have their own emotional issues with how to handle social media, tell me that Pete Alonso is going to be unhappy. That's garbage. Put that aside. You don't know what's in his head. And personally, I don't either. But I don't think somebody would sign a contract, come back, if they didn't want to be where they wanted to be. I think certainly there's been enough back-end rumblings that what happened at Amazing Day with the fans, and look, the fans, you have to take some credit. Your reaction, your love that you showed for Pete, I think pushed this. Maybe not in the high percentage way, but it was a factor, I think, in this whole thing. The fact that, Cohen, who is a hands-on owner, and he got out of the boardroom, and he got out of the spreadsheet and saw his constituents, his fans, his customers telling him, "This, we really want this," and him saying, look, I'd love to get this for you, but I can't get this for you at the current price and the current terms. That was such a fair, I mean, it was a brilliant negotiation. It put all the onus back on Alonso. And if you think about it, and taking away the dopes on social media who don't understand the world, much less business, nobody was complaining about Stearns and Cohen after that. They understood, well, these guys are doing what the best they can do. And I'll go back, and we've talked about this so much since the Soto signing, to the point where I'm so happy we're putting a cap on this. But you guys, and you could go back and listen more in depth, you guys know the dangers of power-hitting right-handed batters at the age of 32. And Pete's got that two-year window. And there's no coincidence that the Mets settled on 2 years. They are looking at the same things from a higher level that I looked at, which is publicly available data. And they say at 32, this thing could start going bad. He could start to become a league average. I'm not going to say he's not going to pop home runs or give you energy or be a good marketing tool, but he could become more immobile. He could become more injury prone. The home runs will be nice, but the other parts of the offense that make a complete offensive player will start to decline. And you might have yourself a very expensive corner infielder that at some point you'll question whether you even want him to play every day, and may only play well against left-handed pitching. They couldn't do that. So in the Mets' world, they're getting the perfect contract. They play this well. They pay a little bit more and probably overpay by about $10 million in value this year. They have a more reasonable second year that it's all on Pete. And they're saying, hey, yeah, if you want to opt back in at 24, you know, you don't have a great year. You have an okay year. You have a similar type of year that you had last year. And you want to go at this again, be my guest. You could go back at this game. Maybe gets hurt. So he's going to opt out. The goal here is Boris said, look, I got you a record deal for a year. Essentially, better than you get in arbitration. And now you go out with Soto in a market you love, in a very highly visible market with a highly visible team, and you go out and you go make yourself some money. That's how I would say to Pete, go make yourself some money. Yeah, the home run against the Brewers was great, and what you did against the Phillies and the Dodgers and how you played in the postseason, and maybe he has a couple of those moments again this year, but overall, you go out there and you hit 45 home runs with Soto in the lineup. You have an OPS plus of 140 to 150. You go back to doing some of the things that you did in 2022 when you had 130 RBIs, hit the ball the other way with two strikes. You improve in multiple facets. You have this organization that it's all this investment in infrastructure. Well, I'd say to Pete, there you go, baby. Everything's there for you. So whatever got in your way the last 2 years, put it aside, because now not only will you have your cake, will you have your year with the Mets to see if you really, you know, you go back and try to go back at it with this thing. You may actually, and I don't think he'll ever get it from the Mets. If he's looking for a multi-year deal, 5 or 6 years, I just don't see it. It will be a fascinating, we'll have this conversation again in the offseason. If Pete has a 2022 type of season or better, and there are offers, no more draft pick on the table from a Toronto or, I don't know, Cincinnati, I'll just throw. And I'm not so sure those are out there, because with the looming lockout or a strike, whatever's going to happen, probably more a lockout, I don't know how the free agency market's going to go. So don't be surprised that this is a 2-year deal, because you're going to have to read the tea leaves. Now that, with Boris, unlikely, but something there to consider. So everything in play worked out for the Mets. The Mets won. And you really have to start to say to yourself, as a fan of this team, as someone who covers this team, you really got people who know what they're doing. You got an owner who really knows what he's doing and is willing to invest and push the boundaries of his budget, especially early in his ownership tenure. Who knows what happens as this thing becomes an albatross financially at times. You have a GM that is an assassin, I think, when it comes down to standing his ground. Because all the reports are, hey, Cohen could have came in here and said, you know, I'll do it. Now, Stearns sitting with Cohen, and Cohen bouncing things back and forth and saying, hey, do you want this guy? And Stearns is probably like, hey, I can have this guy, but at this term. And then Cohen basically said, listen, this is what I could do to make it happen. The Mets put their terms down on the table and didn't budge. An amazing day helped. The Fan Fest helped. It swayed things. But it didn't change the fact that the Mets didn't go out there after Amazing Day and say, okay, Pete, I'm sorry. Here's a 7-year deal for $210 million. Because Pete would have signed on Sunday, the day after, if that was out there. You know it and I know it. So this is a fascinating time. It was an exhausting time. Personally, even more so than the Super Bowl, this is the cherry on top of the hot stove offseason. There'll have to be a corresponding 40-man roster move. It'd be interesting if there's anything left. Now, the other part of this, before I get to one other point and we wrap up, I don't want to go too long here. But, so you hear the Mets made a 1-year deal to Jose Iglesias. Now, stop talking about the optionable Madrigal. I talked about this on Sunday. I still see this out in social media circles. Stop talking about Madrigal replacing Iglesias. Madrigal is probably not even going to be on the opening day roster. He is an optional veteran, AAA depth, similar to what Iglesias came in last spring. If anybody's in the way of Iglesias, it's Acuna. And I don't even know if you sign Iglesias to a 1-year deal. Basically, you're putting Acuna, I think, back in AAA. Maybe at some point he comes up and he could be taking a spot for an injury, or you could look at maybe moving Marte. Maybe that's on the table here. I'm not getting deeper into that. But the fact that you're reading, and I read this this morning, and I can't remember who put this out there. It was a reputable source that Iglesias is holding out for a multi-year deal. Well, yo, Jose, you had a great year. We love the song. You know, maybe you're at a point in your career where, hey, I've got the music. You know, I'm busy with the Grammys. If baseball's there, great. If baseball's not, I don't care. But all due respect, I'm sorry. OMG blows up way more because you had 50,000 fans and a whole free, without paid, social media component to the 2024 Mets that helped promote your song. I wouldn't just give that up if I had some juice left in my playing career for a multi-year deal in an environment where, all due respect, you're a veteran, older middle infielder who historically is a below league average hitter, nice clubhouse guy, nice guy to have around, but there's only so many places that are going to pay. No one's going to pay him multi-years. You know, maybe a bad team says, oh, I could use this guy as a veteran mentor, but for 2 years? No, no one's going to give you a guarantee 2 years. It's delusional. And with the RSN issues and with the whole labor strife that's been talked about over and over and over again, come on. And he went to Boris. That is not a good client for Boris. Not a good client. And maybe Iglesias is making so much money in music, he's like, look, if I don't get this, it's not worth the time. There's something you always look at when you, with ball players, and they always say it. When they say that they never retire because they don't enjoy the game and playing. They retire because they don't enjoy the prep, the working out, the travel, the stuff that gets in the way of them having some sort of normal life, particularly with their families. For Iglesias, maybe the music is a thing, and it's like, hey, I'll play baseball, but only at this price. That's what it's worth it to him. That I respect that. That's fine. And I got this music, and this could be something I could do. So he's got options. His options aren't going home, sitting on the couch and talking with his friends about the good old days. And maybe he ends his career with a great cherry on top, where that's how he's remembered as a baseball player, and that's fine. But that's where I see it going. I don't see a multi-year deal. I absolutely think, because I'm not sold on Acuña, although Acuña and the things he provides, like I said on Sunday, in terms of versatility and depth, are very interesting as a guy to have a Swiss Army knife that could start, come off the bench. I like veteran leadership. I like the fact that he could come in and spell late in the game Vientos at a high level at third base defensively. He could spot McNeil against left-handed pitching. Maybe Acuña could do all those things at some point, but he's not there yet. Or at least I don't think he is. And maybe he will be very quickly, but we'll see. So convenient marriage. I think Iglesias is a convenient marriage as well between the Mets and Iglesias for both sides. Not to the same level as Pete. But I could tell you, if Pete Alonso, negotiations were tough, and the Mets stood their ground with potentially the franchise's all-time leading home run hitter, they're not going to be held hostage, for lack of a better word, by a backup middle infielder veteran. They're not going to. They're not going to be held up proverbially from a baseball standpoint, financial hostage from a backup middle infielder veteran. Here's a question that we'll be diving in. I'll leave you with this, okay? This is what I'll leave you with. So the Mets, historically, have been a team built on pitching. But they've had some really good offensive teams in their history. You think of the mid-80s Mets, the 86, 87 Mets. You think of the 06 Mets with Reyes and Wright and Delgado and Beltran. Of course, I always talk about the 1999 Mets with the big year that Ventura had, Piazza in that lineup, Alfonso, Olerud, and then some of these big seasons that component players had, like Roger Cedeno and Daryl Hamilton, and even Ray Ordonez had one of his better years there. And you think about great offensive Mets teams, and now with this team, with Pete in this lineup, with the power he brings, and you look, and currently the lineup that you would have here is Lindor, Soto, Alonso, Nimmo, and this is not necessarily a batting order, I'm just putting their names out there, Vientos, some combination at DH of Jesse Winker and Starling Marte, Alvarez behind the plate, McNeil at second, and then either Tyrone Taylor or Siri in center field. Siri could probably bat ninth and play that elite defense in center. You definitely need that. I'm always willing to sacrifice up the middle some offense for defense. And you look at this lineup, and you look at, if healthy, if you have Lindor, who's in his prime, smack in his prime, could be able to give you something similar to what he's given you the last couple of years. And Soto being that top 10 all-time elite hitter. Alonso being better. Maybe he's not going to be vintage 2019 Alonso, but he could be pointing more towards 2022. Can Nimmo get back to first half Nimmo? Maybe the Nimmo that Rung creates with power and be more of what you saw in June and July or May and June. Vientos continue to evolve and improve. You've seen the numbers. Winker against righties and Marte against lefties. That could be a DH that provides you better production than what J.D. Martinez, or you thought J.D. Martinez was going to give you, with maybe 20 home runs, 80 RBIs, an OPS of 800 or better. And then, of course, the real wild card is, can Alvarez enter the conversation? Maybe he's never going to be Mike Piazza as an offensive player. That's a big, lofty goal. But can he be a guy that shows more discipline at the plate, hits 25 home runs, provides you power towards the bottom of the lineup? You already know he's a value behind the plate, which is something that never was advertised as he was coming up through the ranks. That could be a huge, you're looking at 30 home runs from Lindor, 30 home runs for Soto, 30 plus, maybe 40 from Pete, 20 to 25 from Nimmo, 25 from Vientos, 20 from the DH spot, 25 from the catcher. And then you got McNeil, who maybe shows a little bit more power like he did the second half of 2019, understanding that was the juice ball year. But the McNeil you saw in the second half of the year sacrifices hunting for hits like Pete Rose for some line drives and power. And then whatever you get out of center field with Taylor and Siri is gravy. Is that the best offensive team in Mets history? And I want you to think about that. I haven't been prepared. It was something that came up right before I came on air. I'm really not prepared to dive deep into that. But if you just go and you look at total runs scored in the history of the franchise by an individual club, the best offensive team in Mets history by total runs scored is the 1999 team with 853 runs. The 06 team is next with 20 runs less at 834. Then it's the 87 team with 823. The 2000 team, which surprised me because that's post-Olerud, and I think the Olerud Zeal swap hurt them a little bit. But 807, the 07 team, a very underrated offensive team at 804. And those are your top five that have scored 800 or more runs. Funny, the 2022 team that we all loved and was a good offensive team, not on there, but had brownouts at various times. The 2024 team that had some good moments offensively, not on there. You don't hear the 86 team. I mean, it's funny, as much as we love the 2022 team and you had the big year by Pete, the big year by McNeil, the big year by Lindor, the big year by Nimmo, they didn't even score as many runs as the 97 Mets. That's pre-Piazza, Hundley Mets, who had guys like Baerga in the lineup and Manny Alexander and, Alfonso, not quite before he became the power presence out there. Lance Johnson, I'm just throwing names, Brian McCray. It's funny at that point. So, where does this team stand? Can this team score at a level of the 99 Mets? And I think part of that is the stars doing what they do. But what made that 99 Mets team special offensively is that when you had a Darrell Hamilton or a Sean Dunstan, I think that's why Nimmo is so critically important. Ricky Henderson and what Ricky Henderson, may God rest his soul, did at the top of the lineup at the age of 40, an elite leadoff hitter in the mold of any, maybe not, it was one of his better on-base years of his career, even though it might not have been in totality, one of his best seasons of a Hall of Fame career. What he did was important. So that's why Nimmo, whoever's at the top of the lineup, I think is critically important to achieving that goal. But between that, the depth, and I will tell you, if they are able to put that together, it will give them a big advantage, especially as the staff tries to figure itself out with guys like Montas and Clay Holmes trying to prove that they're valuable mid to the top of the rotation, probably more mid-rotation arms. It'll allow the bullpen not to be burnt out and overused, particularly Diaz, because maybe you could have some days when you're playing a second division club against a bad pitcher where you could have some separation and not worry about bringing in your high leverage arms, because here it is, it's the eighth inning, two outs, two runners on, and somebody with a big bat, big home run bat comes up, and God forbid you don't bring in your A reliever. If he pops a home run, you're tied. You don't need that. You want it to be 8-1. And then if there's some sloppiness, you still win the ball game. So that is going to be another question. It'll be an interesting question. How does this line up now with Pete Alonso? Knowing what Pete can give you, the floor that Pete can give you that you're expecting, even if he doesn't have a great year, and the excitement of what he could give you. It's a great question, and we'll dive more into it. So that's what happens when you sign and invest in known talent. Look, Jared Young, Brett Beatty, Vientos at first, whatever they were thinking about doing. I'm not saying that was a bad plan, and it's not a crazy plan, and I do believe that Stearns was ready to go to war with that. But this is what made the Yankees in the 90s and the 2000s so special. They knew, and I think it was like a guy named Bubba Thompson coming into play center field before they went out and got Johnny Damon or something like that in 05. Bubba Thompson, I can't remember the guy's name. It doesn't matter. But the Yankees go out, I think, late in the winter and get Johnny Damon. And you were saying to yourself, well, the Yankees kept saying, we're comfortable going with a component guy in center field. No, Johnny Damon's out there. Let's get Johnny Damon. And sometimes you go overboard on that and you sign bad contracts like Jacoby Ellsbury. But more than not, you don't. And the fact that you have an owner and a president of baseball operations that did it responsibly, where now the Mets could even go out and sign Vlad Guerrero next year, which is a whole other conversation. There's so many pitfalls in that too. The Mets have so many options because Pete's going to probably opt out unless he has an awful year or gets hurt. So the Mets have put themselves in a position where they can win now, get the best out of Alonso now, maybe continue the marriage, depends, and maybe improve upon it. And that's how you have a sustainable winner. You should feel really good as a Mets fan this morning how this went down. You got what you wanted. The Mets were able to maintain a responsible flexibility, and the process really should make you feel good. Your involvement as a fan of the process, Cohen listening, and how they handled the player, and they let the player wander, but they never let the player off the reservation too much where they couldn't get a deal done. So anyway, thanks everybody for tuning in on this snowy Thursday morning, emergency edition, Super Bowl Sunday. We're not going to be doing a radio show on Super Bowl Sunday. We'll be doing our next show, will be our pitchers and catchers report. Unless the Mets want to make some more news. I'm not sure an emergency show about Jose Iglesias is in the cards, but so no show on Sunday. There will be content over the newsletter. Check that out. I got some ideas of things to do. If you're not a paid subscriber, would love for you to jump on board. Less than a cup of coffee a month. Great discounts to sign up for a year. That's my sales pitch. It's pretty simple. All right. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G. And I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, substack.com/@talkingmetsnoG. And I want to thank the good folks of the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I am your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.